On Perspective last week, economist John Webster identified significant areas for improvement in the island's economic policies, and last month's budget was met with significant concern. Was Treasury Minister Alex Allenson surprised by the criticism his budget received?
Was I surprised by the reaction? Probably no, because this was a very different budget to the ones that had come before it. It was a very difficult budget in terms of facing up to the realities of government spending and the provision of key frontline services, but also trying to position the budget as part of a far wider government policy, both in terms of the island plan, which we're going to be debating in March, Tim Walz, the update of that and refocusing on some of those key priorities, also the economic strategy and driving that forward. And on top of that, the other things that are going on in terms of Treasury, looking at the National Insurance Fund and the role of that, and also looking at the tax strategy going forward, which again will be debated in March, Tim Walz. So no, I absolutely expected a reaction, absolutely expected some people would not like it at all. And we do have a number of groups on the Isle of Man. It was interesting that the BBC have started describing the Chamber of Commerce as a lobby group. I don't see them as that. I see them as a collection of local businesses. And you're quite right. They did a quick survey of their members. Just over 200 people replied, and the vast majority of those were opposed to the budget. But when you drill down to some of the comments, it wasn't just about the budget. It was about a whole range of things and the whole range of things that the budget is responding to, particularly in terms of inflation, skill shortages, the price of housing, the access to housing, problems with connectivity, the global, I suppose, pessimism that's around at the moment. In terms of both the economy, but also the state of the world, and a whole range of different comments there, which I have gone through and reflected on. Again, it would have been easy to have done another fudge and drawn down from reserves. When I took my first budget last year, I was criticised by Tim Walz members who said, you're drawing down on reserves, you're taking money out of the National Insurance Fund to put into healthcare. We don't like this. We want you to find a different way. Now, a lot of the comments on the budget were about government reform and the size and scope of government and the cost of government and getting that under control. And I think that's absolutely right. And this is something that the Chief Minister will be talking about in March, Tim Walz, in terms of the update on the economic plan, when he talks about fiscal discipline being the core defining strategic priorities going forward. But as a Treasury Minister, I have to respond to the demands of individual departments. They've gone through several years of increasing demand, increasing inflation, both in terms of wage and non-wage inflation. And so the critical decision the Treasury team had to make was, do we start cutting services or do we try to fund them? And that's why we brought in this temporary increase in the upper rate of income tax as a holding measure while we debate the taxation strategy, while we look at other ways of providing government income, especially for the health service. Because I suppose that's the main driving force of a lot of the overspends and a lot of the extra demands and the extra demands, both in terms of people's healthcare needs, but also their expectations. And we need to manage those, but in both cases, but also meet them.
Perhaps one of the things that surprised me about the budget is that you have gone straight into the support for the high-spending departments of health and education. Now, education, you could argue reasonably, if you have better educated people, then you are going to have a more productive workforce. So there's sort of an argument there that supports the economic strategy. Departments like the Enterprise Department, also DOI responsible for an awful lot of the infrastructure on which this shiny new economic vision will be based. They're not really getting significant increases, particularly the infrastructure side, which has been savagely cut. If you want people to come to the island, they need to know that they've got reliable services to and from the island. They need to see the island looking spick and span, which is, again, what you talk about. But in politics, you follow the money, and the money doesn't seem to be going into the things that you're talking about.
I'd agree with you in terms of some of the comments you made there. In terms of capital spending, that has to be restrained. We're still yet to deal with the Liverpool ferry terminal, which we've finished the prom to a degree. There's still people who say that work needs to be done on it. We're now coming out of a period of significant capital spending and significant overspends to do with inflation and COVID. I won't rehash all those. I think what we've been trying to do is be very honest with people, saying we can't carry on spending tens of millions of pounds on these large, huge projects without getting that fiscal discipline there. And that's what the recent Public Accounts Committee report on the Liverpool ferry terminal said. You really need to do the work up front. You need to properly cost it, properly schedule it, and make sure that you're providing what you need rather than necessarily what individual departments want. So that's why in last year's budget we brought in a different way of bringing forward capital schemes after they've gone through the project development fund, after they've been fully worked up. In terms of DOI, again, you're absolutely right. There were a conscious political decision was made after the 2008 financial crisis that the government would cut public spending. I do not disagree with that. I mean, it was also around at the time of the VAT, a bombshell as well, and government had to face up to cutting back spending. And DOI was hit. Also, Department of Home Affairs was hit. The Department of Education was hit. A whole range of departments were hit. And now we're catching up with some of the long-term consequences of cutbacks in key public services. In terms of having the infrastructure on the Isle of Man, I think what we've been doing with the Department for Enterprise is looking at how we can leverage private investment to provide that. And that was one of the key fundamentals of the economic strategy. So the infrastructure investment scheme, you know, helping the brownfield site development in private hands has started, and hopefully we will see, you know, spades in the ground around Lower Douglas and in other areas. The Manx Development Corporation, the stuff they're doing with the former nurses home, they've now got planning approval, although there's still a degree of appeals.
And I suppose people's frustration are, this was announced last year, and you know, here we are a year on in and we're still talking about it.
But that's to do with the planning process, and that was one of the key things that, again, this administration was going to look at. It's taken time, because for every new development that's there, for instance, Westmoreland Village, 133 new homes right in the centre of Douglas. But I was answering questions, and the DOI minister were answering questions in the House of Keys about where are people going to park, how is it going to be financed. We are pushing ahead, and I think, you know, this year in particular, people will see to the delivery of some of those key projects moving forward. The former nurses' home will be opened by the end of the year. People will be moving in. People will see that development. But some of these sites that are being developed have been vacant for decades. There are intrinsic problems with them, and so it's going to take some time to get those up to scratch. But part of the work of the Built Environment Reform Programme is to look at planning, absolutely have the input from local people into the planning process, but where it can be speeded up, where it can be done for the right economic and social benefits, actually provide those facilities. The other aspect, obviously, with the Department for Infrastructure is the restructuring and looking again at the scope of an organisation that runs an airport, a port, the roads, everything else. Right, you know, Heritage Railway, is there a better way of concentrating that expertise rather than spreading it out so widely and being fair to the officers who work there?
In terms then of the budget, And I did ask you this question directly after the budget, but I'll ask again because perhaps you've had a bit more time to reflect. What was there in the budget that you could have pointed to, or that businesses could have looked for and saw, oh yes, this clearly indicates that Isle of Man government is on board and is doing what it can to help us. What specifics were there in that budget?
Looking at the budget, one of the key things that everyone's concentrated on, quite rightly, is the 2% increase in the 20% rate of tax. That is there to fund those key services. And health, education, infrastructure, all those things that we're putting extra money into, and looking at putting extra money into the project development fund, the transformation fund, all those sort of things, are creating that package for the Isle of Man. It's not just about having low tax rates. And again, if you compare us to the adjacent isle, we still have low tax rates. And the quality of services. And again, we're looking at the adjacent isle. We're seeing some of the breakdown in those services. And I think we have to be realistic about what it costs now to provide a modern education and healthcare service.
You're listening to Perspective with Treasury Minister Alex Allanson. So in terms then of the tax strategy, so the first thing in the foreword, there's a reference to the island's economic strategy aspires to increase public finances by $200 million per year by 2032. So is this £200 million per year from the pre-COVID levels where things were better perhaps than they are now?
Well, when you look at the economic strategy, it's based on the work that KPMG did, which was just about the time of the pandemic and trying to see how we would lift the island out of that. So we're really trying to benchmark around about, you know, 2020, 2021, those sort of areas. The idea behind increasing government revenue was obviously to have that investment in the economy, and that's not just roads and bridges and airports, that's also people, and investing in people through skills training, through education, through adequate healthcare, through public transport. But key to that is looking at the tax burden, and because we are a low tax jurisdiction in terms of corporation tax, and always have been and always will be to a degree, we are getting most of our revenue from people. And so when I'm faced with having to decide whether to draw down on reserves or raise income, it tends to be people who pay, either through government fees and charges or through taxation. And also in terms of what the report shows is those levers that the government have to raise taxation revenue are a bit constrained by our reciprocal agreement with the UK over VAT and duties. So really what we have is national insurance, which is ring-fenced, and Tim Wilde was very clear about that, to pay for pensions predominantly, but also income tax and how we can adjust that in terms of the rates and the thresholds. Now, successive Treasury ministers have either kept the rates the same or increased them. I'm the first one to change the rate. So the thresholds, I'm the first one to change the rate for quite some considerable period. But it fits into the tax strategy of trying to look at government finances and, again, how we can get that extra funding into particularly healthcare, but do it in a way that doesn't penalise working people. So it does fit into that economic strategy, I believe. Going forward to raise that extra revenue, but to do it in the right way. What we're also looking at is other ways of raising revenue, such as seabed leasing and the next shiny thing that comes on in terms of an economic opportunity. And the Department for Enterprise are out there looking for all these things, investigating ways of bringing in AI and everything else that might be developing. But the core function is to make sure that we can afford the services that the people of the Isle of Man demand and deserve.
A significant part of the service delivery in the UK and the Republic of Ireland is delivered through taxation, which is gathered via local taxation. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't happen to a very large extent here, but certainly in terms of the water and sewage rate, effectively, that's a government-provided service which is funded through the rates. There's no reference at all to that taxation stream, because let's be honest, the rates is a tax on the value of your property. Why was rates excluded?
I think you're quite right, and we're seeing some of the results of that in the adjacent island, in the United Kingdom, where things like social care, public health were put on local rates, and they're now having real problems providing those services. At the start of this administration, the Chief Minister and the Council Ministers, I was there, we sat around and said, right, do we want to pick up the mantle of rates reform, which had been developed, and Chris Thomas had done quite a lot of work on that in the previous administration. But it had become quite clear that really rates reform was interlinked with local authority reform as well. And that's a huge mouthful to bite off. And it was a strategic decision at the start of this administration to say, no, our priority has to be the economic strategy, the island plan. We will look at rates reform as and when it turns up. But rates reform, you really need to tackle it in the first year of an administration. You need to hit the ground running with it. It was not seen as the key priority coming out of COVID to start talking about rates reform.
In which case, if it needs to be done in the first year of an administration, surely to goodness, work needs to be done in the next 2.5 years so that a new administration is ready to introduce some form of change.
Yeah, I mean, if I can just say that's my personal position. It's not a government policy that thou shalt do rates reform in the first year of administration.
And of course, the reason that you would want to do that is because inevitably there's going to be winners and losers. Yeah. And in politics, you hear a lot from the losers and very little from the winners, no matter where it is. And particularly when it comes to tax, the losers are going to be very vociferous. So many of you, anyway, value your position in Tynwald and don't want to be thrown out at the election. So you do the unpopular stuff fairly early on in the administration.
Yeah, and one of the issues with rates reform is that there'll be 50% of winners, 50% losers, particularly in rural parishes. And you've got to have a way of phasing that in, which is most of the models say about 10 years to phase that. So actually that pain doesn't go away. It's not one. It is a long process. And certainly from my point of view, that I think we can provide local services in a more effective and efficient manner. I think a lot of local authorities are doing that anyway now. They're looking at better ways of refuse collection, of cooperating together in terms of local amenity sites, in terms of we've seen some good collaboration in the south about the swimming pool provision and how that should be paid and looked after. And I'd like to see that evolving rather than central government dictating to local authorities, because we've also seen what happens then. And actually then the local community say, no, we've elected people to represent us locally. That's what we'd like to do. And we've seen recently with Braddon, local democracy in action. Really, in terms of decisions made by the commissioners to invest in a facility that's got long-term costs, long-term benefits from their point of view as well, absolutely, but long-term costs, and is that the right way to spend ratepayers' money? So in terms of the tax strategy, yes, we have shied away from switching the tax burden onto rates. If I've done that, you would possibly have accused me of stealth taxes. We've been quite honest.
I'll be accusing you of that later.
Fantastic. But I think people's perception of rates is the provision of local services rather than providing education, social care, health care. They see that's coming out of central government taxation. That's not to say we shouldn't have rates reform. That's not to say we shouldn't have local government reform. But I'm hoping that will come through by an evolutionary process driven by those people who are going into local government.
The reason, of course, that rates is raised is, first of all, local taxation in the Isle of Man is as low as it gets, certainly compared with, as I say, the UK and the Republic of Ireland. And it is very much within our control. Income tax is within our control, but if we alter it too much, we potentially scare off business that we would want to have in the Isle of Man. VAT, we can't really touch because it's part of the reciprocal agreement, which works well for the Isle of Man. National insurance, similar to tax. So the reason rates is probably quite important is it is something that you can do. It's incredibly low at the moment, and it is within the gift of politicians on the Isle of Man to decide the levels.
True. I mean, I'd be careful saying it's incredibly low. It is with that perspective. With adjacent aisles, I'd agree with you. But for somebody on a low income, the rates bill is large, and they want to see the results of that. And they see the water and sewage rates, obviously, in there, which, again, are very competitive with across. And they see the provision of local services, and particularly parks, gardens, the state of the pavements, refuse collection, those key things that they pay for. I'm certainly not keen on adding to that burden and sort of shifting that. And I'd probably be accused of shifting deck chairs if I was to do that. What I think would be interesting, we've done lots of modelling about, are people better off on the Isle of Man than across? And when you look at national insurance, and our rates haven't changed dramatically, although in the UK they've cut them. If you look at our taxation rate, it's much lower, but the national insurance skews that a little bit in terms of working people. If you look at the overall tax burden and bring in rates into that, yes, people are still much better off on the Isle of Man, but that's very rarely talked about in terms of, as you say, local taxes. And so I think it's that perspective that we have to have. But as I think you've just pointed out, in terms of the tax strategy, it is a little bit limited if you cut out rates and rates reform and everything to do with that, it is a bit limited in terms of looking at income tax, direct taxation, but also looking at corporation tax. And that's why this document is very different to the previous document, which was which emerged in 2012 after a public consultation.
Well, let's then look at, we're still only on the executive summary, but cross-cutting objective is to remain competitive. Mm-hmm. Now, some have argued, John Webster, I think, argued in last week's programme, that some of the changes introduced in the budget mean that we are substantially less competitive than we were. People have been posting various comparisons between Isle of Man and UK taxpayers, suggesting now that the UK taxpayer earning £30,000 a year is probably better off than the Isle of Man when you take into account the change in national insurance that was mm-hmm. introduced. So if the cross-cutting objective is to remain competitive, have you not actually moved in the opposite direction?
No, because I think I made it quite clear when I moved this year's budget that what we were doing was, in some ways, a reset in terms of government finances, looking at an increase in the tax rate while we developed the healthcare levy as a different way. And how the healthcare levy will work is it will extend to other incomes, not just working people's incomes. So this budget was very much part of a medium-term financial plan, a longer-term process of providing the amount of money that government needs, again, not necessarily wants, and we need those efficiency savings and that fiscal discipline and scrutiny, but the right amount of money that government needs to provide essential services whilst then reducing the overall tax burden. Because, again, that's one of the key objectives is to keep the tax burden for individuals as low as reasonably possible. But I think we have to be also honest in terms of those services that we provide and those services that people demand and what we can do on the Isle of Man.
So let's then look at the objectives in the tax strategy. The first one, we will raise sufficient taxes to meet our needs through a sustainable and diversified tax system that has flexibility to adjust as and when circumstances change. Well, first of all, it's a bit like stating the blindingly mm-hmm. obvious. But secondly, you do mention a sustainable and diversified tax system. So it would be interesting to understand what a diversified tax system looks like, because that implies that something is going to change.
I mean, again, that's looking at the dominant way we raise government income by taxing people and what they do. So VAT, income tax, national insurance. And when you look at those strands, that's people who spend, people who earn, and people who work. What we've done over successive decades with the 010 regime is have very low corporation taxes here, which has attracted businesses that have employed people so that they can spend and earn and make money. Moving forward, we need to reimagine that, particularly on the basis of some of the minimum global tax rates, and say, how does that change our positioning? Because the situation we were in several decades ago of being tarnished as a tax haven and being ostracized as a low tax jurisdiction are changing. We've seen other countries develop their taxation system to rival ours or even be better than ours. There's been a bit of a race to the bottom in terms of corporate tax, and that has harmed overall government revenue, whilst the island has become more wealthy. If you just look at GDP, people aren't experiencing that in their pockets who live and work here. So one of the opportunities that's arisen over the last couple of years is the OECD bringing out what they call the Pillar 2, which is basically the large multinational companies of this world that have a turnover of over 750 million euros a year will be taxed 15% wherever they are in the world, wherever they do business. And if they're doing business on the Isle of Man and don't pay tax here, then they'll pay that amount of tax where they're based. And often with the large companies we've got, that's in the UK, where they brought this in January this year. So by looking at how we can still remain a competitive jurisdiction in terms of 010 for small and medium-sized companies, but how we can make sure that those companies that are based here pay the tax that they have to pay here, I think we can move forward in terms of government income. The interesting thing is how we can still incentivize those companies to stay here or relocate here. And that's where we come down to the overall package of infrastructure investment, health, education, skills, housing, everything else to create and maintain the Isle of Man as a really good place to come and live and work. And that's part of that package. The other things we brought into the tax strategy are a tax on hydrocarbon extraction. I don't know whether that will become a reality, but absolutely we should have that. We've also, with the KPMG report and the work that Ørsted are doing, are looking at the opportunities for utilising the revenue benefits of our territorial waters. Now, part of that will be covered by Pillar 2 because also they're a large multinational company. So if they're making profits within our territorial waters, they'll be paying tax for that. And we don't want to disencourage their significant investment that they're planning to make. So there are a range of issues there whereby we are changing with the past, but still trying to keep that 0-10 headline to keep those small and medium-sized companies, which are the backbone of our local economy.
The next objective, and I fear we're not going to get to the end of this tax strategy, despite many saying there's very little in it. Next objective, we will ensure that the tax system is fair and equitable, that the tax and benefits regime result in a progressive system, and that the tax burden is kept as low as is reasonable. And yet, the budget appears to have done the opposite. I think later in this strategy, this is acknowledged.
Yeah, it is. We've looked at it. And again, what I made quite clear, and people will hold me to it, is the increase in the upper rate of income tax is a temporary measure while we bring in other measures. Why do we have to bring that first before we developed a healthcare measure, a healthcare levy? Because that needs primary legislation, we need to work that through and talk to Tim Wald about that before we can just bring it through in a budget. I don't think that would have gone down well at all. Whereas an increase in a rate of tax we can do relatively quickly just by changing some of the parameters of the income in the income tax division. This is a temporary measure. We are also looking, obviously, and I made a commitment to look at the thresholds, both of tax and child benefits going forward into the next year's budget. But there is that absolutely imperative that we will keep the tax burden as low as reasonable. And that's the overall tax burden. So that's not just income tax. It also, increasingly, in national insurance, we are becoming quite different to the United Kingdom with their ending of Class 2 contributions, their reduction in rates. We were better than them, certainly in terms of rates. They are now undercutting us, and we have higher thresholds than they have. Even though they haven't changed their thresholds, we upped them in the budget. There is that difference. So that needs to be looked at, and that's one of the parts of the National Insurance Review that we'll be bringing to Tim Wald this year to look at that. But in terms of the priority actions, we did a consultation on owner-managed businesses and the way that people are self-employed but pay themselves a dividend, and was that fair? And so we are looking now at developing legislation to enact that. Unfortunately, some of that is quite complex and does take some time, but we are absolutely committed to looking at that going forward to make sure that those people who are eligible for national insurance benefits, particularly things like pensions, pay their fair share into the system.
Okay, so we're almost through the objectives. The cross-cutting objective to remain competitive, the sustainable and diversified tax system, and a fair and equitable taxes. So those are the first and second, and then there's the cross-cutting one. The final objective is I've described here as the Earth will continue to travel around the sun. Mm-hmm. We will continue to comply with international tax standards. Well, gosh, we would really be hitting the headlines if we decided that we weren't going to comply with international tax standards.
I mean, it is an option under Pillar 2. If you've only got a few large multinational companies within your jurisdiction, you cannot implement the tax. And actually, Malta have said already that they won't. Those companies who operate in Malta will still be paying that tax wherever they're based, but they've made that decision. And the do-nothing option was there. But last year, we together with Jersey and Guernsey, made a commitment to bring this in. And again, why? I suppose one of your first questions may have been, why on earth are you bringing a tax strategy? Well, it was in the Ireland plan. And we haven't had a tax strategy since 2012. Part of this document is outward looking. It's saying what we're going to do, but what we're not going to do. And it's trying to sort of draw a line and create that level of certainty For investors, but also for some of the international bodies who look at us still with you know, hardly with rose-tinted glasses, as that offshore jurisdiction that could be a bit dodgy. We're saying, well, actually, no, we are going to comply with all the international best practices. We're going to share information. We've had all the conversations about beneficial ownership and things like that. We know what's coming, but we're going to try to still keep that competitive edge to make sure that the Isle of Man is still a great place to base your company, to employ people, and to live in.
As part of the diversified tax system, one might have expected things like perhaps land speculation tax, taxes on property that is artificially left empty or allowed to deteriorate significantly. Much of that, well, certainly the deteriorating in property could be dealt with through the rate system, but that appears not to be on the cards. When we go down then to the priority actions certainly indicate that some of these things are possible, but there's no specifics in there about new forms of taxation. And using the tax system, and again, this was a point that John Webster made last week, using the tax system to influence behaviours. Mm-hmm. We don't seem to be trying to do that.
I listened to the interview, and you know, quite a few of the comments he made absolutely resonate with me. One of the comments he made was the amount of time it's taken to do this tax strategy. We've been working on this for the last year to try to get it right, and it's gone through several iterations, partly because it was a council minister's decision to limit this to this administration rather than have a 5 or 10 year strategy. Because we didn't want to necessarily, you know, commit the next administration to something that they may disagree with. And certainly, I think when we have the debate, there may be people who say, well, you should have inheritance tax, you should have capital gains tax, you should have what is classed as wealth taxes. This quite clearly states we're not going to do that in this administration. Coming on to your the subject of derelict and unoccupied buildings and, you know, derelict sites that are rented out as car parks rather than developed. That's being dealt with very much through different means. We're doing a lot of work and actually consulting with local authorities at the moment about ways that we could tweak the zero rate system for empty and derelict properties to bring those back into use. And it's that carrot and stick option. But also look about those empty sites. Can we have a nominal tax put on them? Now, this is more of a local matter that I'd like to really work with local authorities about to meet their actual needs, and is slightly outside the tax strategy. And we talk here about the fact that we don't have a stamp tax as they do in the UK. We do have registration fees if you buy and sell properties. And we've already tweaked those to try to incentivize owner-occupiers above and beyond people who buy to rent or perhaps external speculative buyers of properties, because there was quite a lot of concern, certainly in 21 and 22, where were people from overseas buying a lot of the houses, particularly down in Castletown and places like that, because the local people seem to be priced out of that market. I'm hoping that DfE will be able to come back with a lot firmer data on that now, and it does seem to be most of the time it's local people who are buying houses. Some of them are buying to rent out, and we need to look at the private rental market to make sure it's fair and equitable. But at the same time, we know what happened with the controversy about the landlord registration bill when that came through and there was kickbacks. We need to be quite careful how we tread there. But again, I think a lot of people have seen what's not in the budget and perhaps what's not in the tax strategy and criticised that. A lot of that details are in the Ireland plan and the economic strategy. And so what the budget and the tax strategy underpins is how we're going to pay for it all.
And one might expect that 2.5 years into your term in office, this government's term in office, you might have been doing more than just investigating a new levy ring-fenced for the health service. Mm-hmm. You know, the priority action is to investigate this. Later on, we find actually that it's a little bit more than just investigating, because by this time next year, you hope to have in place mm-hmm. the legislation so that this levy can be introduced in time for the April 2025 tax mm-hmm. year. There's so little detail about this, mm-hmm. though. Why is there so little? I mean, you might expect that if you've been politics, thinking about this for 2.5 years, you might have got a bit further.
I haven't been in Treasury for 2.5 years. I came in May 22. So the first year was just trying to get my feet under the table and look at how we dealt with some major increases in the cost of living during that year and the war in Ukraine and all the knock-on effects that had in terms of inflation, and then got a little bit of breathing space to look far forward. Why have we got to investigate? Because I need to get this through Timbald. I need to make sure that the idea of a healthcare levy, which we never really had on the Isle of Man before, resonates with political members, and we can explain it to the public as well.
And is this the same, or would it be extended to cover the residential care? Because, of course, there's an investigation going on into whether there should be a levy for that.
There is indeed. At the moment, no. I mean, at the moment, there's been a full public consultation about whether the state should pay for social care, how much individuals should contribute towards that, how much the taxpayer should pay for other people's care, how it should be spread out, and I've yet to see the results of that. And there are various ways that might be paid for in terms of different taxes or different charges or putting it on income tax or indeed a levy. The levy that we're looking for here is in terms of the health service is looking at meeting that funding gap that was identified by the Sir Jonathan Michael report and by serial Treasury ministers in terms of the increasing cost of the NHS, which tends to be above inflation, the increasing scope of provision of services, and how that's funded. Now, what Manx Care are mandated to do is bring the healthcare service in on the budget that they're given. And I think that's going to be their major challenge this year, because, again, they really need to deliver both in terms of the budget, but also the outcomes that people need. And that was one of the things that we were talking about in the House of Keys only this week, in terms of how they would be held accountable and when people would see the benefit of the extra money they're being asked to pay.
Can you perhaps understand some of the concerns raised by the Chamber of Commerce and indeed others that, I mean, you just said there that Manx Care will be held to account to ensure that their budget, they keep within budget this coming year. Well, why hasn't that happened in the past few years? Why hasn't that happened across all the departments of government? Yeah.
I mean, all the departments of government have been under quite strict financial control. Healthcare services, as a rule, have always seemed to go for supplementary votes at the end of the year. Is that poor resourcing? Is that poor control of demand, or is that inevitable on a small island with a growing population and a growing elderly population, and also growing expectations of what the health service can provide? I think it's a combination of all of those. The creation of Manx Care was very much at the initiation of Treasury at the time, to look at other ways that healthcare could be structured so that it provided good quality, safe services, and could do that at arm's length from the department. Because previously, when the Department of Health and Social Care were running the health service, it was constantly overspending and under-providing. And so this is a new way of trying to do it. I think we're now into the third year of Manx Care. Now is the time that they really need to deliver. But that fiscal scrutiny is still there and will be more emphasised now as we come out of that high inflationary period and as we rebalance the budget so that we're not drawing down on reserves to the extent that we have been and can actually start putting money back into those reserves, which is part of the medium-term financial plan.
When will we, the members of the general public, get to see what this new healthcare levy is going to look like?
We're going to March Timbald for a discussion about it in terms of the tax strategy. What I'd then like to do is work with members about some of the parameters of it and come back to the House with the legislation that's necessary to bring it through and look at who should be levied, what income should be levied on, all those different parameters, and that will go through a full democratic debate. It's not at the diktat of the Treasury Minister to bring this through, because it needs to be legislated.
And I suppose the question was, when are the public going to get to hear this? Not when is the Keys going to have a debate on it? Because ultimately, Keys members will do their best to reflect public opinion, but the public weren't aware of this when they voted you all in at the last election. I don't think many, if any, politicians talked about the health levy. So presumably there needs to be some level of consultation with the public about what they would expect to see as a result of this.
No, absolutely. And the same in terms of some of the proposed changes we might make to the national insurance system. I think we do need to get people on board. That's difficult with a budget, particularly when you're dealing with taxation increases, to have consultations on that. Back in 2012, they did a wide range consultation on what the tax system should look like. And it is funny how things change, because at the time they said this was one of the largest responses the division's ever received to a consultation, and it was 66 people. that was in 2012, before the internet, before online consultations. I've gone through their responses, and of those 66 people, there were 66 different ideas about how the tax system should develop. Some people were saying get rid of national insurance, and we've seen that only recently in terms of the UK budget.
I wasn't going to put you on the spot there, but seeing as how you raised it, I feel that I can. UK Chancellor has mentioned or has announced that the UK is potentially going to scrap national insurance. Now, of course, this assumes that a Tory government is re-elected in their election, which is coming up in the next 12 months. How would that impact on Isle of Man government plans?
The question is what you replace it with. I mean, the national insurance contributions go towards the National Insurance Fund. The largest payment from that is for people's old age pensions that they've paid into over decades. So if you get rid of national insurance, you get rid of that burden on working people, how do you then provide for their futures? Now, in the United Kingdom, they can borrow money to fund that as a pay-as-you-go scheme. Here, we've always had that security of having a national insurance fund to deal with the ups and downs of the economy. So you know you've always got the money to pay people's pensions every week or every month. And I think we do need to look at that. We do need to look at the tax burden on working people, and again, making taxes as low as reasonably possible, while honouring our commitment to those people who have paid all their life and have come out of it and want to get that return in terms of a guaranteed state pension or other benefits that are paid out the NI fund. So I think it was a bold move for the Chancellor to do that. I mean, there are some people who'd say, is he laying mines for the next administration in terms of boxing them in? I think what we need to do on the Isle of Man is, and we will be bringing this to Tim, we'll just having a debate about what the National Insurance Fund should look like, what it should do, how much of that we can invest in local infrastructure like houses, like other developments here. But primarily also guarantee to people that they will get a state pension and that there is that certainty going forward, because I think that's very important. I think, during my budget statement, I said that I thought we needed to split from the triple lock. That's lifted a lot of pensioners out of poverty. But all the actuarial projections we've shown looking at the NI fund shows that if we do nothing, it will be extinguished by 2047-48. So we need to do something to reset that. I don't think we're at the stage now of getting rid of national insurance altogether, because then you're putting the burden onto income tax again. And we've seen how popular a 2% rise is on the upper rate of income tax. If we were to try to, raise the extra £380 million that goes into social security benefits, the vast majority of that in pensions, how much extra income tax would that take? And I don't think that's been something that's been answered by the UK Chancellor.
One of the areas which has raised some concern is the move that's taken by many people to establish themselves as a business so that they can avoid having to pay national insurance on their income. Now, maybe that's a bit of a blunt way of putting it, and some people would say, oh no, I've set up my business for a whole range of different reasons. But effectively, if you are a sole trader business, or if the owner of the business is a key player in the business, this is a great way of avoiding paying national insurance. Mm-hmm. And you're looking into that, but that of course has raised some concerns by people who are struggling as they are, because they potentially are looking at paying an extra 11% on their income.
Absolutely. I mean, we went out to consultation for this. It has been a commitment by various Treasury ministers before me to make our system as fair as possible. And that's what we're trying to do. We're looking at owner-managed businesses. We're looking at how we can transition people into the situation whereby they're paying a fair share of national insurance for the benefits that they're eligible for. And it's that fairness which I think is key. But at the same time, that has to be part of an overall reform of national insurance to reduce the burden on working people whilst trying to maintain the benefits for those particularly who've retired. And that's a balancing act that the Treasury needs to deal with, both now but also long term, going over the next couple of decades.
Well, sadly, we are starting to run out of time. We're on to page 4 of, how many pages are there in the 16 meaningful pages in the tax strategy when you take account of the covers and various things. So perhaps there's more in this tax strategy than we thought, if we've managed to speak for the last half hour or so on the tax strategy. What I did promise, because you raised it, that we would talk about was the stealth taxes. 21% of government income, government revenue, is not the taxes we've just been talking about. So presumably that 21% is stealth taxes, and all the fees and charges, I think in the budget it was mentioned, are going to increase by 15% over the lifetime of this Parliament. Is that
well?
That
I mean, I'll challenge you about stealth taxes, because
I only used the term because
absolutely, because it has come into the vernacular as along with gold-plated pensions and bloated civil service, and these have become a reality for people. When you drill down, what we're talking about with fees is government services and the idea that the user of those services should contribute towards them, whether that be a subsidised bus fare, whether it be applying for a passport or rates, for instance. You know, you're paying for the services that are provided, as opposed to all of it being provided by the taxpayer, whoever he or she is, and trying to get to that sort of user pays idea, but also being realistic that those services cost more now than they did 10 years ago, that to make sure that we keep up with the cost of those services, we need an incremental rise in those fees. So, putting bus fares up for the first time, I think, in about 10 years to 50p, well, it wasn't very popular. But actually, bus fares, the price of a bus driver, a bus, and the fuel it uses are significantly higher now than they were. And again, that comes out of the DOI budgets. They've got less money to spend on the roads and the infrastructure that we want to attract people here. So I think looking at the fees, what we're trying to do is make them honest, make them appropriate for the services that it provides, but make sure that they keep up with inflation. Otherwise, we see some of the sudden jumps where people have forgotten to put a fee up for 5-10 years and then suddenly want to do a 20-30% rise. I think if you can be honest with the people and say, well, this is going to go up by 3 or 4% because inflation's gone up by 3 or 4% each year, and we'll round it down to the nearest penny, I think people are more appreciative of that rather than some of the sudden rises that we've seen in the past.
But again, being honest with people, the people who have the least available income have to pay exactly the same for these services as the people who potentially own several yachts and mansions.
Yes, they do, but we still then have a quite comprehensive benefit system. We have, for instance, in public transport, a whole lot of different subsidies for younger people, for people on free school meals, for older people, for people with disabilities. So there are a range of safety nets there, but it's trying to get, again, taxes on people as low as reasonable and providing those services. And I think that realism in terms of the cost of those services, the cost, it now takes to drive a bus around the island, and therefore what the fares should be and what they could be, I think is something that this administration is willing to grasp during 2020 and 22. We brought in a £2 bus fare. We did a whole range of things to help people adjust and adapt to a new economic and inflationary environment. We're now coming out of that and trying to actually have that certainty and sustainable finances going forward so that we actually have a balanced budget and we have an island where we can invest in the economy because we've got the spare cash to do that.
That was Treasury Minister Alex Allanson, MHK. Did he convince you? Are you concerned at government's direction of economic travel or reassured at the steps being taken to address the gap between tax and spend? Don't forget this programme's available as a podcast. I'm Phil Gawne. Thanks for listening.